Hillary, Rocky Stucci here, EBN Special Report. Can you tell us how you feel about the possibilities of the server that you erased is, well, I guess, not so much erased?
Sure I do.
Good. Because a man that doesn't spend time with his family can never be a real man.
Parental discretion is advised for the young, more sensitive viewer, more sensitive viewer, more sensitive viewer.
Well, good evening, good afternoon, and good morning, depending when and where you're listening to this episode of EBN Special Report with me, of course, Rocky Stucci. Now, folks, I know, people get sensitive when we talk about things that are not politically correct or not popular with mainstream media today, but after you hear the interview that I have tonight, I really hope that you sit back and think of what is really happening in the world that we're visiting and living in today. People don't like when you talk about corruption. People want to pretend that everything is cool. It's all good. But if you backtrack to some of the episodes here on EBN Special Report and we talk about events. We talk about 9/11. We talk about the war in Iraq. We talk about ISIS. We talk about the takeover throughout the world of these quote unquote immigrants that are now savaging countries, terrorizing their residents. And the majority of the public have this perception that all of these immigrants are fleeing from danger. I will say that a small percentage really are. I will say a small percentage are in desperate need of help and are trying to survive. They're trying to raise their children. They're trying to put themselves in a safe environment. I don't need to tell you what's happening throughout the world unless you're pretending it's not existing. I don't need to tell you that Germany is upside down. I don't need to tell you that Sweden is upside down, or France, or Italy, or Greece, Romania. All these countries, folks, that came forward to open their borders to help these refugees now have no choice but to close their borders because their own citizens are being terrorized. Their own cities, their own towns are being set afire. There's nothing we can do to make these people happy, these ones that are rioting. You give them water, they throw it. You give them food, they don't accept it. But then they complain about the conditions that they're living in. And I'm not going to get into this because this is an important episode tonight. I'm not going to get into why are not the countries responsible for their own people taking care of their own people. I'm not going to get into that tonight as much as I want to go on a tangent right now. But there is something much, much bigger at play here, folks. There is something much bigger happening than perceives our brainwashed eyes. And I know people don't like to tamper in these conversations. I am not blind. I'm not an idiot. I'm not afraid of the truth, because if we can't face the truth, then we can't face nothing. What we see today, folks, is a huge reflection of what happened on September 11th. September 11th. And I know you sensitive, there's sensitive people out there. I know. I get it. There's no absolute way that there's any kind of corruption with the two planes going into the Twin Towers. I get it. So I wanted to have a guest on tonight, Rebecca Roth. Now, Rebecca was a flight attendant. She was a flight attendant for 20 plus years. And after 9/11, she was not just dead set out to go debunk 9/11. It was not meant to be that way. It's just how it happened. So I wanted to have Rebecca on here. I wanted to have her on here. And this is going to be a multiple part series. There is just way too much information to try to get in one show or two shows or even three shows. I've talked with Rebecca and she has agreed to come on as many times as it takes in order for her work to be heard. She's putting a lot on the line by exposing and sharing the research that she has obtained. And everything she comes forward with can all be validated. All the information that she gets can all be validated. So while you're listening to this show, I strongly recommend that you go to Rebecca Roth. It's R-E-B-E-K-A-H Roth, R-O-T-H.com. And she is the author of Methodical Illusion, and she is the author of Methodical Deception. So you can go to their websites, but if you just go to ebntalkradio.net, right on the front page, just scroll down a little bit, you will see a copy of her book on there. Just click on that link and it'll bring you to her sites. So when I brought Rebecca on for this episode, we instantly started talking about 9/11 and our thoughts on it. So I just ended up hitting the record button. So when I bring this in, this interview in, it's going to be midstream during a conversation, but it got going so well, I didn't want to do the whole let's start and stop over and repeat ourselves again. We just went with it. And we were talking, well, she was talking because I was just, and anybody who listened to the show, I'm not short of words. I usually have too much to say. But this is another scenario where, just like when we had Scott Bennett on our show, you just kind of sit there with your jaw dropped and you wonder, what kind of world do we really live in? What kind of a world are our children going to grow up in? How can people treat human life with zero value? How can people treat human life with such little value or to no value? I just can't comprehend this. I can't comprehend what people would do for power, money, and resources. And I went a long time avoiding the whole 9/11 subject because a lot of people died. But I believe that the families of the victims of the fallen deserve to know the truth. I believe the American people deserve to know the truth. I believe the world deserves to know the truth. So this is no conspiracy theory. This is no whack job conspiracy theory. There's something bigger here at play, folks. So I'm going to cut into this interview. Now, as you know, EBN airs Sunday nights at 8 o'clock. It is a one-hour show. Well, this show is going to go longer than that, but I'm only going to be able to play the first hour live. So in order to listen to the episode in its entirety, you just need to go to ebntalkradio.net, and the episode in its entirety will be available there. So again, RebeccaRoth.com. Please go to her website while you're listening to this interview. So here's the interview between me and Miss Rebecca Roth.
Put my novel aside and just kind of dove into everything I could. And the first thing I found were people that were mostly retired professors, and they just bloviated bull crap.
Right.
And there was so much nonsense out there that I was like, well, no wonder people call them crazy conspiracy nuts. I mean, it's just so, it's such nonsense. Like all the planes flew to Cleveland. Well, I'm sorry to tell you this, but I flew out of Boston. So Boston to Cleveland's a 2-hour flight.
Right.
And so those planes wouldn't even got close to the ground until after a ground stop had been put in place. So impossible. And then they go on to say that they were all loaded up into a holding tank at a NASA center and then put on one of the aircraft. Well, there's more people than would fit. You can't just fold them up and put them in the hat rack. I mean, that's crazy. And you're also not going to ever take passengers that have been hijacked, literally.
Right.
However, by the airline, by storms, or by air traffic control, and take them to a commercial airport where they can get out and rent a car, because they'll have a mutiny. And people don't understand that if they've never dealt with the traveling public. And so all of these things. One guy said that the flight attendants were kidnapped on the way to the plane. And that they really weren't there at all. Somebody thought the flights didn't even operate because they weren't on BTS. I mean, so you just have to know, when you know the airline industry, you're like, what? People are buying these books that are saying this nonsense, and they're out there on the lecture circuit charging money for this crap. Well,
and I think that's what it is too. I think this is where it becomes kind of a fine line when people talk about 9/11, is because such a majority of people have some of their theories are so far out there that it discredits the people that actually have very legitimate theories regarding 9/11.
Yeah, weren't very many of those, because I think I'm the only one actually that has come forward with how it happened, what happened. And, you know, when you read these books, and this was my agenda, was to wake up, not you, if you've been into conspiracies or if you've been, you know, following all these nut jobs, but Joe and Mary on a farm in Ohio that always thought there was something suspicious about that crash in Shanksville or that crash in the Pentagon. Those are the people that this book reaches. The Methodical Illusion, the first book, wakes people up. I'm telling you, I was on Coast to Coast AM. My book went to number 9 overall at Amazon.
Wow.
And I sold thousands of books. And people contacted me because I told them, hey, you can. And the most interesting people, and I mean, I've autographed books to people in their 80s and up to 95, 97 for their birthday. And they're like, this is all I wanted for my birthday, is Methodical Illusion.
Well, congratulations.
They all know. Older people know. They really know.
Well, what do you think the biggest fear is?
Well, I think what happened in looking back now, because you have to understand that, I mean, I was there. I was, and just like everyone else, I was getting all my information off the media. And so, for me, I was listening with flight attendant ears, so I was hearing different stuff, and I was hearing things that were not right, that were impossible, that were against protocol, that weren't following the rules. And we had set in stone protocols to follow in a hijacking, things you definitely wouldn't do. And that's what the flight attendants were doing. And I'm like, wait a minute. And so as I just kind of dove into that, I realized that overall, after I put it all together, the president of the United States and the media brainwashed us through a trauma. Guess we saw the most protected building in the world, the Pentagon, struck, supposedly.
Right.
We were told that, even though Jamie McIntyre was there and said there was no airplane crash here. And we didn't see any airplane crash here. And there were all these weird stories about these planes being gobbled up by buildings. That particular wing of the Pentagon had just been reinforced with steel and Kevlar. And it was brick, and it was many, many layers of brick. And impossible that an aluminum aircraft can disappear into buildings. Yet we saw it even disappear into the ground at Shanksville. They found no bodies, no luggage. Now, just recently, we saw German wings, remember, crashed in the Alps. And if you'll recall, I mean, I saved some of those pictures because they were really high definition, and you could see people's clothing and broken luggage and stuff scattered all over that mountainside. And that's what you would see in a crash, parts of the aircraft. You always see the tail section. None of that was there. The titanium engine parts or the landing gear, none of it was there at Shanksville. None of it was at the Pentagon. And so I think what happened, we were brainwashed through trauma because we were so traumatized. I mean, I think most adults, people that were adult at the time, can close their eyes and see that falling man coming out of the tower, that he jumped to his death. Mm-hmm. Now, you've got a whole group of people, like flat earth type people, that think that guy was a dummy, but he wasn't. I mean, I've been contacted by people whose spouses and family members were inside the towers and didn't make it out. Right. And they really are dead. And so you've got this whole group of whack jobs out there that are saying, oh, nobody died on 9/11. The flight attendants were voice morphed. They didn't die. The planes didn't operate. Just complete and total nonsense. Now, one of the things I did learn is that the perpetrators actually set this up. And so part of calling you a name like a pinhead, or let's see, there's a pinhead, they like to call you a truther, they like to call you conspiracy theorist. That whole phrase was created by the CIA to keep you quiet. Right. All of these disrespectful labels that if anybody questioned, and if you will remember, I mean, I don't think it was the same day, but within the week, George W. Bush, the president at the time, he stood there at Ground Zero and he said things like, you're either with us or you're with the terrorists. He made you choose a side. And then he said something that really bothered me. He said, let us not get caught up in wild conspiracy theories. And I remember hearing that, watching that live and thinking, why would the president say such a nonsensical thing? We all watched this. We know you guys are telling us who did it. You've been following him. Why would you say such a thing as that? Well, now I know why.
Exactly.
Because it was a charade. And it was all an illusion. This was the biggest card trick ever played on America. And through my first book, Methodical Illusion, what I really wanted to do was help the person who always doubted what they thought they saw or what they were told was really happening. And maybe they saw something that wasn't quite right wherever they were at and just kind of didn't quite feel right about it. And so what I did was I took my protagonist, a senior flight attendant, much like myself, and her name is Vera Hansen, and she is in cognitive dissonance. She doesn't want to know. She just is in denial. She doesn't want to look there. She doesn't want to know that the government was either complacent or part of this. So she's just got that aversion. And I think a lot of us do. And one of the things that her big fear is being labeled as a kook or a nut or a whack job or a pinhead or a truther. And so I think because of that, when the people read it, they connect with her. And then as she goes through, she meets a character that's a scientist that explains to her about some of the ingredients that were in the dust that pointed to some sort of explosions had taken place in there that you wouldn't find from jet fuel or an office fire.
Right.
And so she starts gradually opening up to, uh-oh, and then piece by piece by piece, and then there's a character in there. Now, there was so much stuff that took place on 9/11 that I discovered. I'm like, wow, how am I ever going to write all this without looking like a nut job myself? Because it's so complicated. Right. And I didn't know. I was just like everyone else on the street. I only knew what the media had told me. And we were not privy in the airline to anything special. I mean, if we asked a question about the hijackings, the stairs would knock you over. I mean, it was taboo. You couldn't talk about it. You couldn't ask about it. They didn't go over it ever in training. We had never been told about Osama bin Laden or Al-Qaeda or warned about them prior to 9/11, which I found really odd because my first question on the morning was after I was like, what do you mean cell phone calls from altitude? They don't work from altitude. Was how did this guy, some terrorist, whoever it was, some terrorist, how did he get control of NORAD in our military?
Right. No.
That was my question.
I'm sorry. If you can just explain this before. This is kind of a very key part regarding cell phone calls, because there were cell phone calls that were recorded that supposedly they're at a high altitude and you cannot call through a cell phone when you're 20 plus thousand feet in the sky. Is that correct?
That's correct, especially then. And around 2004, maybe somewhere in there, American Airlines, if you'll remember, they even made this huge announcement, did a advertisement campaign that you can now call from your cell phone. And so some people were like, wait a minute, they were calling from their cell phones on 9/11, weren't
right,
they?
Right.
Well, at the time of 9/11, you couldn't get any cell phone from about, you know, 1,500 to 1,800 feet, depending upon the city you were either leaving or landing at, and where their cell towers were placed. Because once you get going really fast, you literally go from cell then, especially because there was no other technology like they have now. But you would literally go from cell tower to cell tower. And so you're going, you know, say at altitude, you're going close to 500 miles an hour. You don't stay connected to a cell tower very long, even if you could. And trust me, I tried it because I commuted from the West Coast and East Coast. So I had a long time to try texting and do I have any bars? What does it happen? And I was talking to a guy who has his own aircraft. And we were talking about this, and he said, geez, I was in my own plane the other day, and I thought, I'm going to turn on my cell phone and see what happens. And across, now, this is just this year. And across the screen of his phone, it said, forbidden. So, no, they don't work. And that was one of the first red flags for me is, wait a minute. They're not calling from a cell phone. But, in fact, they claimed, and they still do pretty much to this day, they've tried to go in and scrub and change a lot of stuff.
Sure.
But if you can find the original stuff that was coming through the media, most all of the phone calls from Flight 93 that went supposedly into Shanksville were cell phone calls. Impossible, because they were at 39,000 feet.
Unbelievable.
So that's kind of how I started to look at this whole thing, and when I realized there was insurance fraud, there was stolen gold, there was $240 billion with a B as in boy, Brady bonds that President George H.W. Bush had put together when they collapsed the Soviet Union economy 10 years prior. They were expiring on September 12, 2001. They were held in the Cantor Fitzgerald office, which was a target of whatever flew into the tower. So I started to see things like that, and my coincidences stacked up higher than the towers were.
Right.
And connections like that to government and corporations that ended up going to the Middle East to do oil and gas pipelines, drilling, support. And it's mind-blowing, the connections. And when I got all of those put together, I thought, well, there's got to be something I missed. And so I went back and methodically, one reason I chose that word, I methodically went through, starting with Flight 11 out of Boston. They started making phone calls, and it was only two flight attendants that made phone calls. So for me, it was perfect. I was like right there with them. And I know the protocol. I know what they should have done and should not have done, and what they should have said, who they should have talked to and who they shouldn't have talked to, who they should have called, if they could have called, how they could have called, and all of those things. And when I started to look at the details, and now I'm reading FBI transcripts. And so when I see that Betty Ong calls in, she's 20 minutes or so out of Boston. And I say 20 minutes or so. So if you have any trolls that like to listen to your channel, the reason I say that is because government documents have the phone call starting at 8:18, 8:19, 8:20, 8:21, somewhere in there. So I can only go by what the government documentation is, and that's why I say it's kind of roughly. So I just ballpark about 20 minutes out of Boston. I literally have had some weird retired professor truther that's written a dozen books go over this about this 1 minute. 1 minute. I'm like, okay, you can find, you know, 10 different documents on when those calls started, and they'll all give you, you know, several different numbers. But that's the way some of these retired professor bloviators are. They'll pick on one little thing, like 30 seconds, I can be right. You're wrong. And I've been attacked by them, viciously. It's just been insane. So anyway, what I did was I listened to Betty Ong was the first caller out, and one of the first things she said, first off, she called reservations, which is not a phone place you would call in an emergency and a hijacking. You would go through the cockpit, and if she did call to the company, she would not have called reservations. She would have called her supervisor or a security line of some sort, crew scheduling, anything but reservations. They don't deal with flight attendants at all. And so I thought that was really odd. And then later on, the spinners came out and tried to say, but I know this isn't true because American flight attendants have contacted me, that the flight attendants had their own special hotline. That's not true at all. that, because it makes no sense that a flight attendant, to any of us, would call our reservation signs, because just like you, we'd be on hold for 10 or 20 or maybe 30 minutes. And in a hijacking, you wouldn't want to be on the phone for any length of time. Right. And they, both of the flight attendants on flight 11 were on the phone for 27 minutes thereabout. Again, that changes by the document you read, but, and by the federal government document you read. So it's not just blogs or goofballs. It's by federal government data. So I started to look at that when she said, one of the very first things she said was he, as in only one hijacker. Both of those flight attendants pointed to only one hijacker. And she said he had sprayed pepper spray or mace in business class, and we can't breathe in business class. And I knew from my own experience, if you sprayed, both of those things were illegal to have on board.
Right.
And if you sprayed pepper spray or mace, the hijackers would have sprayed themselves, and they would have been suffering. If you've ever been around pepper spray or mace, you'll know that's not a pretty picture. So it would have gone to the pilots, whoever was flying, whoever, whether it was hijackers or our regular pilots, the passengers and the crew members. And yet both of these flight attendants were on the phone 27 minutes, and neither one of them ever complained about the effects of that pepper spray or mace. They just said he had sprayed it, and it was in business class only, and that's impossible if you're pressurized.
Right.
And so if you're not pressurized, you're sitting on the ground, well, something might sit up there, because she's 150 feet away from the action, so she really didn't know. Both of these flight attendants were in the very aft section of the aircraft. The aisle's about 159 feet long from the tail end, from the aft to the cockpit door. And so that's a long ways away. And you get a double-wide aircraft like that. One of our problems when we work it is communication. I mean, so I was usually in charge. So if something was going on in coach, if somebody was injured or choking or had a heart attack or something, they had to communicate with me, because I didn't know what was going on back there, because it's just too far away. Same with them. They didn't know what was going on at front. So for her to be reporting about this was really weird. And then she said something else that really got me. She said he stood upstairs. And I thought, well, there are no stairs in that kind of aircraft. She was on a 767. There's only stairs in a 747. And I thought, well, she's not pressurized. She's talking about stairs. That means she's in a hangar. And so what I started to do then was to see all the things she said. And she said, we can't communicate with the pilots. We can't talk to the pilots. Okay, well, I know why that. One reason to cause that is that in the early 90s, there was a company. Now, the coincidence of this is really amazing. The company was owned by the comptroller of the United States Pentagon, Rabbi Dov Zakheim. Mm-hmm. It was called SPC Corporation, and they created a product they sold to Boeing called the Flight Termination System. The flight termination system was sold to the airline. Carefully listen to what their sales pitch was. And think about 9/11 and those four planes that they want you to believe there were hijackers flying them. In the event of a hijacking and a hijacker took control of the cockpit, we can land the aircraft remotely, wherein it will be liberated by some Delta Force or Rangers or Navy SEALs or some group like that. And so you have to ask yourself, okay, on 9/11 we had four aircraft that the government would like you to believe had hijackers at the helm, that they were guys that didn't know how to fly a Cessna and somehow were flying wide body 767s and 757 aircraft like they were fighter jets. Impossible, right, what they claimed they were doing. So you have to ask, well, then if they had these, which they did, American called theirs the flight interruption system. And if they had these, why they didn't use them? Because they were already in use. And when she said, we can't communicate with the pilots, they're not answering their phone. What happens when the flight termination system takes over? And this is why a lot of the pilots did not want to have it. The airline I worked for, we did not have it. Flight termination system works on the same frequency as the airplane's transponder. The transponder is how air traffic control sees your aircraft on radar. And so once it takes over and hijacks that plane, you disappear. They don't know where you're at, what altitude you're at, what speed you're at, who you are. All of a sudden, you're just nothing. And they also would lose all communication, including with the cabin and the flight attendants. And now, where are their eyes and ears? If there's a cockpit door, and it's shut and it's locked, and it was at the time of 9/11. So if something's going on, whether it's a hijacking or somebody's having a heart attack, they don't know unless we call them and tell them. And so same thing when happens when we do land the airplane in the event of a hijacking. We would land the aircraft. That'd be our first and foremost thing. We would coordinate. All of the phone calling would have been from us to the pilots, and they would talk to security and those forces on the ground that were there to liberate us, the hostage rescue team. And so they would say to us, you know, we're going to come in the very aft door on the right-hand side of the aircraft at, 8:15. So get ready. And when we do, at 8:15, we want all the flight attendants to hit the floor because we're coming in and shooting.
Right.
And that's the kind of communication we would have had through the pilots to us. And so, you see, none of that was going on. And the pilots also, if somebody came into the cockpit, you know, crashed in through the door with their box cutter in hand, or a gun or whatever, there's a crash axe inside the cockpit that's a lethal weapon. And there's two guys in there. Both, all of the pilots on 9/11 were military trained, so they're all trained in survival. They know how to fight. And that cockpit crash axe is there, and it literally it's there in case they need to crash out through the cockpit door or through their windows to get out of the aircraft. So I started to see, oh, the flight termination system landed them. And so I knew that the aircraft were heavy with fuel, not so much with passengers, but with fuel. So they'd need at least a 10,000-foot runway, 20 minutes from Boston. And I found it. And so what I did then, I actually teach the reader how to go in and go to a website, which I was using, and put in the city codes or the airport codes for this. One is an Air Force base, so you have to put in the airport code, and then you can pull down a heavy jet, kind of wind you want, and figure out how long was the flight time. So after I realized that both the flights from Boston made it to this place, then I thought to myself, I didn't want to take this step, but I thought, well, I wonder, how about that flight from Dulles? Well, lo and behold, the minute those phone calls started, and there were only two people that called out, a flight attendant and a passenger from Flight 77, they were on the ground. And then I punched in Newark, and the same thing. And then I realized that since it's impossible to make cell phone calls, and in that Flight 93 from Newark, they were well into cruise altitude, according to the National Transportation Safety Board, the FAA. They were at 39,000 feet when the hijacking started. So I knew then that all four planes were taken to this base. My first interviews, I've never ever said the name of the base. I just said there was a base in Western Massachusetts. They were all remotely taken over. Now, when the aircraft was taken over, they couldn't squawk the hijack code. They couldn't talk to other planes or air traffic control. They lost all communication. And that's really why pilots didn't want to have it installed. Mm. Because we hadn't had a hijacking since D.B. Cooper in the United States. So, you know, and that was like in the early 70s, maybe 70, 71, too, somewhere in there. So you can see that what I saw then, and then I started to look really close at the two flight attendants on Flight 11, and Amy Sweeney did something no flight attendant would do. And she said, she called her supervisor, which was at least a smart place to call. She said the hijacker was a guy sitting in 9B. Well, she called back. Now, if you were going to make a phone call, you don't want to make a mistake like that, because chances are you're not going to get a chance to make two phone calls. Sure. And she made like four. But she called back, and she said, oh, I made a mistake. The hijacker was in 10B. Well, again, she's in the second to the last row of coach. She's 150 feet away the whole time she's on the phone, so she doesn't know what's going on. But someone must have told her, or told she was letting this out, because I looked at to see who 9B was, because I thought, wow, that guy almost got, you know, he could have gotten killed by a SWAT team or a hostage rescue team. Well, lo and behold, 9B He was a highly trained assassin. He was an anti-hijacking specialist, and he was trained in hostage rescue. So that told me that he, in hostage rescue training, they are the guys that come on and liberate the plane and the passengers and crew. They know how our doors open on every Boeing aircraft. They know how to make a PA announcement. They know where our emergency equipment is. They know about as much as the aircraft as we do as flight attendants. And I thought, wow, what are the chances? And they killed him with a plastic box cutter? Well, I started to look in this guy, and he's trained by an Israeli Defense Special Forces Special Operations Unit called Sayeret Matkal. And they are like, I compare it to Israeli Jack Bauer. Because these guys can, and according to his friends, they all said he could kill any human being with a pen and a credit card. He was fluent in English. He grew up in Denver, moved to Israel when he was 14. He was fluent in Hebrew, and he was also fluent in Arabic. And so if there was anybody sitting behind him planning this new Pearl Harbor hijacking of this aircraft, they were sitting talking less than 2 feet away from his ear, and he could have overheard everything. Just stop for a minute and think about the last time you flew, that you, the conversation you overheard from the people sitting behind you, because they're sitting facing forward and your ear is right there. So you always hear what people are saying. So if they were really hijackers on board. Well, one of the things I found out, that there weren't really any, there were not 19 Arab hijackers. There weren't any Arab hijackers on board in the real passenger manifest. And what I discovered was it's the FBI who had been cooking up all of this crazy conspiracy stuff, like the 19 hijackers. They originally came out with three different names. And the 19 we now know, if you look in Wikipedia under 19, because they first came out with four other men that were on the list. And oops, one of them was an FAA employee, was a flight safety instructor in Florida, very much alive and was in Florida. So he called in and said, wait a minute, I'm not a hijacker. And I wasn't there. And another guy with his same last name who had been killed in a small airplane crash 1 year prior on September 11th, 2000. And then two other guys, I just don't remember where they worked, but they showed up. We're not hijackers. We're still alive, and here's where we were, and we're very much alive right now. And so quickly, the FBI changed their story and said, oh, the real passenger manifest had these other guys on it. Well, they chose four airline pilots from Air Tunisia, Saudi Air, and I think one of them's from Morocco Air, but they're kind of Saudi citizens. So the Saudi government, and this is a document I found, was suing the FBI for stealing the identity, including the photos, and using the home addresses of some of their pilots and citizens.
So out of the 19 supposed hijackers, they didn't match up to actually being on the plane? Is that...
That's correct. They weren't on. They were not on the passenger manifest at all. That's a lie, a total lie by the FBI. Like I said, they first said they had this passenger manifest with these 19 hijackers, and they were four of them were different names than you have right now. And that was all done in the first 72 hours of releasing the names, because three of them showed up alive and one of them was dead. So like it would be like I would say to you that your brother was one of them, and you would say, oh, no, my brother died in a car accident, and he's been dead for 3 years. And so if I were on TV as the FBI saying that your brother was one of the hijackers, you'd come forward and say, no, he's not, because he's been dead. And that's what happened with this guy who had died actually in like a Cessna or a small aircraft crash in Florida. So it's impossible that he was a hijacker. But according to the FBI's original release of documents, that they tried to pin this on four people, three of which were still alive. One of them was an FAA employee, so... So, yeah, they're covering up most of it.
So in regards to the planes, Rebecca, if the planes were landed securely in a hangar somewhere, what were the planes that actually crashed into the Twin Towers?
That's a good question. One of the things that's really fascinating to me is since my first book came out, I've been contacted by lots of pilots, including United and American Boeing 767 pilots. That's the first question they usually ask me is, after they say, you figured out how they did it, the bastards, they say, have you figured out how they got a plane to look like it flew into a building like a hot knife through butter, because aluminum planes cannot do that.
Right.
And what you would see is something totally different if a plane crashed into a building like that. It'd gash a hole maybe, but just a hole. I mean, you remember, I think it's in the 40s that a bomber hit the Empire State Building.
Yes.
And that's the kind of damage maybe you would have seen with these buildings. There's no way. So we know whatever they were something, along the line of a bunker buster type of thing that could go right through cement and steel. And an airplane cannot do that. I'm sorry to be the one if this is waking you up. I hate to give you this reality, but that's the truth. And that's what's interesting is the pilots know about the flight termination system. And they also know what happens. And that's why the aircraft fell off of radar. And so what happens after Methodical Illusion came out, and I started doing a bunch of interviews and talking about it, about what I discovered. And the reason, like Betty Ong said, I don't know, but we might be being hijacked. And I thought to myself, no, you do know, because if you're a flight attendant and you're on a plane and there's a hijacker, he's in the aisle and he's making demands, and you know what he looks like and you know what he's demanding, and there is no I don't know, period. There just isn't. And the other thing she said that was really odd, but I found out that most of the people that made phone calls, or certain people that made phone calls, said the term hijacking, but in the air. We're up in the air. We're up in the air. One guy in Flight 93 called his mother, used his first and last name, and even said, "We've been hijacked. We're up in the air. You do believe me, don't you, Mom?"
Interesting.
And when you're hijacked, only takes place in the air. You cannot be hijacked on the ground, because if you are on the ground and a hijacker comes on board, let me tell you how fast we'll arm those chutes and open those doors and get you out of the plane. Hijackings do not take place anywhere but in the air. So it's a redundancy a flight attendant would not say. And so when I saw all these passengers, not all of them, but a lot of them, saying the same thing, that I thought, okay, well, then they've been told to say that, to convince. Like Mark Bingham said, "You do believe me, don't you?" Somebody said, "You better convince them you're up in the air." So what I discovered is that there weren't 19 hijackers, but there were handlers of sorts. It, like the guy in 9B who the flight attendant originally said was a the hijacker, only one on Flight 11, that he was the hijacker, and she wouldn't have made that mistake. And so how could we possibly sit and think, for in our logical mind, now see, I'm going to say this now, at the time of 9/11 we were traumatized, and in that psychological trauma we believed anything.
You bet.
And literally we believed airplanes could fly through steel and Kevlar reinforced brick buildings and disappear. We believed that a plane could crash into the dirt and completely disappear, and you'd never see another person or piece of luggage and part of an aircraft. We believed that, and we all did collectively. I mean, I knew it was impossible, but I couldn't look. I just didn't want to. I was still flying. I couldn't go there. And so we were collectively brainwashed at that point. We were so traumatized. We would just believe the impossible. We would believe that a guy who his friends in the Israeli Defense Forces Special Operations Unit, a trained assassin, fluent in Arabic, allowed a 5'6" 20-something-year-old spindly little kid that could barely speak any English to command Flight 11, a double-aisled, wide-body aircraft, and get into the cockpit door past this guy. And we are expected to believe they killed him with a box cutter, box cutter. I mean, you just have to stop and think about this. And when people start to wake up to the reality of how impossible that is, and now we're waking up. See, I often think about the Men in Black movie, where Will Smith had that little wand with the light, mm-hmm. where he had them forget what they saw. Well, we were all collectively brainwashed like that, and now people are waking up. And they realize when they hear something laid out totally logical, and that's what I did. I just went through methodically, exactly, step by step, everything that was going on, and then I delivered into a novel that's non-threatening. It's entertaining, and it's got tons of truth in there. And then people can go and look that stuff up. You can go read about the Brady Bonds, because they're in history. They're real. And they were at the Cantor Fitzgerald office.
So what about the passengers that were supposedly on some of these flights? I mean, are they just missing? Were some of the passengers fictitious individuals?
Only the handlers were. But there were some passengers, some real passengers, and they are dead. And the crew members the same. I mean, I read one crazy conspiracy theory that said that the flight attendants were fake. They were make believe, and that they were, someone said they were kidnapped on the way from to their airplane. And people just don't understand what life is like. So when I wrote The Methodical Illusion, I wanted the reader to understand what we do when we check in. It's not like you guys where you just go and wheel your luggage to gate, 62. We have to check in with our office because our pay starts when we sign in.
Sure.
And so we get paid about seven different ways. So so when you sign that piece of paper or check out through a computer, you need to be there at a certain set time before departure. You have to sign in and talk to people. You meet your crew. You go over FAA bulletins and that sort of thing. And then usually as a group, you walk together to your gate. It's impossible in a secured terminal to be kidnapped. But yet somebody sold a book, some retired professor sold a book and convinced a lot of people that that was not the case. Now, another reason they do that is that they look at American Airlines never posted in the Bureau of Transportation Statistics. It's referred to as the BTS. The Bureau of Transportation Statistics was designed and created in the, I believe it was in the 90s. And it was for one purpose only. It was a voluntary system. It was keeping track of the statistics of certain flight numbers. So if I was operating American Airlines Flight 11 and Flight 77, and they were both involved in what we like to think that the government would like us to think they were involved in some sort of incident, hijacking or crash or something, they usually, because of the psychological effects of you looking at American Airlines Flight 11 in your hand and a ticket from forever, they usually retire those numbers. I often refer to this as like sports guys. When they get to the Hall of Fame, their number, their jersey is retired. Right. Well, airlines do that with flight numbers, and the BTS was kept track of flight numbers. So Flight 11 went from Boston to Los Angeles, and it operated every single day, unless it had a mechanical or there was a snowstorm and there, something happened to the crew or, something, maybe it would, cancel on, one or two days in a year. But it was its daily scheduled operation. Both of those flights were. And so the reason they were not put into the BTS is strictly because they weren't going to continue to use the flight numbers, and they did not need to keep the statistics on it because they had to assign that flight from Boston, leaving at 8 a.m. or 7:45 when it was scheduled to go to L.A., and they made that a different number. I don't know what it became, but it wasn't going to stay Flight 11, which is why it was never put into the BTS. But if you're not in the airline, you can make any kind of crazy theory about that and write a book about it and go lecture about it and charge people to hear the BS. And then you got all these peons out there. Oh, really? Oh, I mean, the flights didn't even operate. They faked us out, but they did operate. And I've actually talked to many, many of the crew members of best friends and family.
You know, Rebecca, I have to say that you're exactly right. And this is what, when I was listening to some of your shows, you can support all your claims. And that's a lot that a lot of other people cannot do. They cannot support their claims. It's kind of a way they theorize the situation. But everything that you bring to the table, you have not just researched it once or twice or three times, but you validate it with some amazing information. And somebody like me is very grateful for that, because we do see the same thing over and over and over again. Building 7 this, but this and that, and it seems to be a very repetitive story. But I know we don't have a lot of time for this first show here with you and I. Can we just kind of go over really quick in regards to the Israeli art students? I think that's really important to bring up for this first show.
Well, sure. That's in the second book. And so I have two books, Methodical Illusion, which really opens your eyes to all the things that the coincidences that you probably don't know about, and helps you wake up along with this flight attendant. And the second book, Methodical Deception, which I just released the end of August, and the hardcovers have just, I think they hit Amazon 2 days ago for the hardback. They take a little bit longer to print and put together. So, but yeah, it's on Kindle and hardback and softback, the Methodical Deception. And what I did with that one was I continued to my research. And after Methodical Illusion came out, I was privy to a nearly a terabyte of Freedom of Information Act data. And I kept looking other places as well and just gathering stuff. And one day I came across a DEA document and that talked about some Israeli art students that were traveling around the United States. And this was in 2000 and 2001. And I know a lot of people have heard this, and a lot of people haven't heard anything about it, that there were over 200, quote-unquote, Israeli spies gathered up after 9/11, and they were put on an LL aircraft and flown back to Israel. Now, a lot of people know about the five dancing Israelis they busted in New Jersey, and when they went back to Israel, and they were on television, it's on YouTube, the five dancing Israelis talking, and they said that they were sent to the United States from Israel to document the event. And that, if you think about that, let that sink in for just a minute. That means somebody in Israel knew that this was going to happen and sent these five dancing Mossad agents, actually, to document the event using their own words. I'm not putting words in their mouth. It's all right there and you can hear it. And so someone over there knew something was going to happen, or they wouldn't have sent them to document the event. So I started looking through this, and now the DEA was following a group of Israelis that they suspected were part of an ecstasy drug ring, bringing in illegal drugs or making, I don't know how they get where ecstasy comes from. They cook it like meth or what, but they were watching this group of Israelis because they were suspecting that they were in an ecstasy ring, drug ring. And then someone found something very suspicious and kind of started connecting the dots and put out an APB to a bunch of federal agents. And these art students were traveling around. This is an amazing story. And it's actually on my website for methodicaldeception.com. And you can find all kinds of information. If you just Israeli art students and DEA, and you'll get lots of stuff because it's been out there. But no one wants to look at this elephant in the room. Nobody. And so when I started reading through the DEA document, this DEA official had discovered that not only were these guys going to office spaces like for DEA, IRS, federal marshals, but these are offices that were not public knowledge. So they started to think, well, how do they know? How are they finding where our offices are? Not only did they show up at their offices and where they were asking questions about their security, one of them had blueprints of the building. And these sometimes were buildings where they were not standalone federal offices. They were maybe in a mall or a strip mall or in an office building with lots of other different types of offices. And their location was not public. And so they started getting a little bit suspicious. I sent out an APB to federal people and started collecting this living document. There's a 61-page DEA document about all kinds of cities and federal agencies where these art students from Israel were coming over. Now, let me just say this. It's illegal to come to the United States on a tourist visa, which is what they were, and work. You can't be selling art or anything else. They were catching these guys. Well, once they started to get suspicious, they started IDing them and asking them for identification. They were in the DEA document. You will see their Israeli passport numbers. Some of them gave Israeli Defense Forces military ID, and some of them gave military IDF Mossad. That's like our CIA. It's intelligence. They've got several different branches of intelligence. And they would give their Mossad ID. And some of them were bomb experts. And so, you know, some people in the federal government started thinking, well, this is really weird. Well, then there was another group of foreign students. They were art students. These are separate now. This is a whole separate group. They came over to New York. They were sponsored by the Lower Manhattan Cultural Center. And they actually were living on the 91st floor of the World Trade Center. And they had tents set up in there. There's pictures all over. You can just Google search this. They called their name of their art project, their troupe, Gelatin, as in blasting gelatin. Gelignite, it's often referred to. And they called their art project the bee thing, as in boy, bee. And they wrote a book about it. It's actually, you can probably see it on Amazon. It's out of print, but you can get a used one for $200. Again, you can find this. It's on my website for the book as well, under the resources page.
I'm there right now.
And if you go to the resources page and then you click on the top left box where it says the Israeli art students at WTC, click here, you'll go back to these photos. And I found this really interesting because these photos were, there was an article written, a very big article written in the New York Times, and it came out August 16th or 18th, right before 9/11, 2001. Right before 9/11 hit, they did this huge dissertation. So what they did, their art project was to remove a window of the 91st floor undetected by security, which they did, and to place out a wooden balcony. And if you put a Google image search in your computer and you start looking, you're going to see some horrific drawings of people jumping or falling out of the towers and some horrible comments. I mean, it's really sick. And so what they did is they built a wooden balcony and set out there. And their sponsor from the Lower Manhattan Cultural Center had rented the top floor of the Millennium Hotel and had a bunch of his friends show up. And he'd also rented a helicopter. And you can find this too, because this is not, it's not secret. This is not a secret document. It's out there. There's even one article where it says how much his helicopter bill was. He rented a helicopter just to take photos of these art students standing on the wooden balcony off the 91st floor, undetected by any security. This was before 9/11. And so after 9/11, they came out and they said that whole thing was a hoax. We didn't really do it. We never did that. But you're going to look on my page there under resources, and then you go to the Israeli art students. You're going to see three pictures that proves to you that they were there. And that's the 91st floor, and they're standing in a window area. You can see repelling gear, because if you pull a window out, and they had to remove a window, they didn't open. You pull a window out on the 91st floor, you're up there around 1,000 feet, you're going to get a wind draft. So they had repelling gear, apparently, to stay connected to the building. And if you look at those cardboard boxes, this is the thing that is really blowing people away. If you look behind the guy in the pink shirt, he is standing in front of a whole bunch of boxes. In all three of the pictures, you're going to see a whole bunch of boxes.
Right.
And on those boxes are two numbers or sets of letters and numbers, and it's called BB18. They're big and bold. They're right behind that guy in the pink's head.
Yep.
That's the clearest place you can see those. And so I got my book out. I sent it to the printer, and I was just waiting to get the proof copy back. And some little voice said to me, well, look up this name of this fuse company, because that BB18 corresponds to Little, L-I-T-T-E-L, Fuse Company in Chicago. So I did a little digging into that, and I didn't Photoshop, but somebody accused me yesterday of Photoshopping those. But those are I just pulled them off the internet. They were part of the New York Times dissertation they did on that huge article on middle of August of 2001. I can't believe New Yorkers didn't put two and two together. Maybe if they did, they just never had a microphone. But I started to look into this. And so I followed this Little, I'm not sure how to say it, but it's L-I-T-T-E-L, Fuse Company. And they're a subsidiary of a corporation called Trecor International, or Trecor Incorporated, excuse me. Trecor Incorporated was bought out by, they were the largest U.S. government defense electronics contractor in the United States. They were bought out by Marconi Electric, which was a subsidiary of GE. And then they were bought, the GE, or whatever they were calling themselves at the time, Marconi Electronic, I guess it was. And they were bought out by British Aerospace, and that became BAE Systems. Several of the passengers that were supposedly on the planes were BAE employees.
Interesting.
So There's a lot of interesting connections with this Trecor company. They had a split off at the time in 91 when they did a bankruptcy. They had three companies: Trecor Defense Holding, based in Austin, Texas, Little Fuse Company in Chicago, and then Trecor Aviation, which I believe now, I haven't followed down on this, but I believe it's called Lucas Aviation. And I'm not sure if they're involved in drone technology, but I wouldn't be surprised because of the connections with everything here. Well, Trecor, when they went bankrupt, they were bought out by a company called Westmark Systems. And Bobby Ray Inman was the chairman of Westmark Systems. They had it for, I don't know, 6 or 8 years, something like that. Now, if you'll remember Bobby Ray Inman, he was the director at Naval Intelligence in the mid-70s, I guess. And then he moved on to the Defense Intelligence Agency. It's also called the DIA. And then he became the director of the NSA. Now, we all know that from Edward Snowden about the NSA, right? And so you see there's a little connection to the CIA here, right? The federal government that was behind all of this stuff. So I started looking in this Trecor. They had bought another company called Vitro. And Vitro had acquired earlier a company called Kellex. And Kellex Corporation was a wholly owned subsidiary of the M.W. Kellogg Company. And it was formed in 1942 so that the Kellogg's operation, which was relating to the Manhattan Project, could be kept a secret and separate. So the Kell stood for Kellogg and the X stood for secret. And the company's goal was to design a facility for the production of enriched uranium through a gaseous diffusion technique. And in that gaseous diffusion technique, you would have isotopes of uranium-235 separated from uranium-238. And they did that by turning a uranium metal into a uranium hexafluoride gas and then straining it through a barrier material like a metal. And so I thought, well, gee, this is really an interesting thing. We've got a connection now back to that other secret thing that happened, the Manhattan Project. And now we've got also uranium. And this is one of the things that's big time in Afghanistan is uranium. And so I start to look into this a little deeper into this M.H. Kellogg Company. You know them now as Kellogg Brown and Root, or KBR. And KBR is a spinoff from the company that Dick Cheney was the CEO of called Halliburton.
Yes.
And so by looking at the artist there, now a lot of people have attacked me because, and I'm not saying that you cannot use a fuse holder for other things, but let me remind your listeners that those art students there that took out a window and put out a balcony, all of those boxes there, the BB-18 corresponds to a fuse holder that can be used for a number of things, one of which is remote control demolition. Now, I have had that reconfirmed by many people in that industry. Coincidence?
You know, and there's a lot of boxes.
A lot of them. And I'm just thinking, I wonder how many of those fuse holders are in those boxes. Because if you look, I mean, just kind of look at the shoulders. Here's another thing to look at closely in those pictures. There is a, I'm not on the website, but I think it's the, on the right-hand side, the lower picture, where there's a guy in a blue jacket looking out the window, kind of bent over, and the boxes are behind him. And he's got his hand behind his back. And if you'll look on those boxes behind, in all these boxes, you can see the international symbol for no smoking, like something that could blow up is in there, or flammable is in there.
Mm-hmm.
So he's got a cigarette in his hand, which I found was really kind of interesting, too. But that international symbol, someone attacked me because they thought BB-18 was some kind of metal floor joist. Well, there were cement floors on every floor. They're not changing the floors out. That building had been wired for electricity since the 70s. It had flooring in there. That's cement floors, by the way. So they're not going to be redoing the flooring because that's cement. You're just not going to switch that out. You just change walls. It's crazy. So I've been attacked for exposing this truth, And I find it really interesting. The people that are attacking this are people who claim to be quote unquote truthers. But hey, this is the way it is. I'm sorry if I found something that offends you or your wild conspiracy theory. But if you just look at this and ask yourself, now this is not part of the art project that they did. And it's kind of in your face. Now, they did this, got away with it, and nobody knew about it until the New York Times printed this in the middle of August of 2001, just prior to the explosions we saw that day in the towers. Now, there's a lot of people that think that whatever it was that hit those towers, missiles or some sort of technology, that these fuse holders were holding demolition explosives, and that they did the cutout, which oftentimes people refer to it as like the Roadrunner cutout that makes the airplane sort of looks like an airplane went through.
Sure.
But if you look at the actual hole, the airplane, one wing was way up by about a 40-degree angle and the other one was straight. And your airplanes don't fold up their wings like that. And so there wasn't enough room for the tail. And if you look at the real angle of the hole, it's just impossible, and it doesn't fit with the tail section. And there was nothing, by the way, ever found on the ground from those airplanes, like a tail section.
Isn't that funny, Rebecca? Because, correct me if I'm wrong, but they said, or they made the claim that they were unable to find the black boxes from these airplanes, but yet they found the passports from these quote-unquote hijackers.
Yeah, I saw on Facebook a really funny meme where they thought they should start building our airplanes out of that Saudi Arabian passport paper, because those things were indestructible. Now, the original story was that two passports were found, one out in Shanksville with only the hijacker, and one from Mohammed Atta, I believe, at after Flight 11, down somewhere on the street. Remember, they gave it to the police chief. Somebody handed it to the police chief, and it was pristine in condition. So there were no bodies found. But, just the other day, somebody sent me this thing, and it was a Fox News. I'll send this to you on Facebook. It's pretty amazing. A Fox News did a story on September 13, 2001, where they claimed that they found the cockpit of Flight 11 with a hijacker still strapped in.
What?
Yeah, I never saw it before, and it's really real. It's an old thing, and they apparently, I don't know if it only showed for a little period of time or what, but I was like, wow, this is unbelievable. It's so much lying. And what's happened with, unfortunately, now we know this because Brian Williams has been caught lying, and he had admitted it, and there's a few other of them. And so I think what's happening now, and it's just the timing, and I don't know anything about you, so I just say this. God's timing is always perfect.
Right.
I wrote this first book, and it sat on the shelf. I was afraid to put it out in public, that I'd be a drone strike and killed. So I had to kind of come to grips with that because of the government work. And the governments that were involved in 9/11, and the Saudi Arabian government is not, I repeat, NOT involved in this. But there is a Middle Eastern country that is. They had a person, a trained assassin on Flight 11. They also had an Israeli Defense Forces woman on Flight 175.
You know, so, the more you research you do regarding 9/11, it seems like many, many of roads go to Israel regarding this whole situation. Do you agree with me on that?
Definitely. Every single one. Now, I have to tell you this. Now, when I remember when I discovered that the hijackers were still alive, I thought it was 19 Arab hijackers that did it, until I realized that they were still alive and that the FBI had tried to finger four different people, one dead and three still living. And then I started to wake up to what the heck was really going on. I went into this thinking that it was 19 radical Muslim terrorists that did it, and it wasn't. So, I mean, I didn't have a pre preconceived idea that it was the United States government, Israel government, or whatever, but I did find Israel involved in every aspect of this, and we can probably do three different shows on all of the connections from that guy that owned the Pentagon, was the comptroller of the Pentagon that had the flight termination remote control system. He also had a subsidiary of SPC called Tri-Data. Tri-Data, after the 1993 FBI bombing of the World Trade Center, because we know that that guy was set up because he tape recorded him. That was an FBI project. At that time, Tri-Data, the same subsidiary company of the people who put the flight termination system on, they got the blueprints for both towers. And they had huge contracts to do the repair work of the towers. And then remember, those were bombs set down below in the basement and that sort of thing. Yeah. So they had huge contracts. And, of course, they're the only company besides the original architects to ever get their hands on the blueprints. That was in 1993. That same guy who was the comptroller of the Pentagon also ran a consortium where he refurbished, with a group of other people, commercial 767s and turned them into military refueling tankers where they were sold to militaries around the world. After he left the Pentagon, he went to Booz Allen Hamilton. That's the company that Edward Snowden went to work for. Booz Allen Hamilton and the Carlyle Company are very much involved with a lot of this, and the KBR, Kellogg Brown and Root, Halliburton.
I think this is, and I think about this all the time, because there was a long period of time where I was, I don't know if you want to use the word denial, but I think you don't want to come to the realization that our own government that we trust so much to protect this nation and the people of this nation, or those involved with an act like this, I think that's the hardest thing to come to grips with, is that they're willing to sacrifice so much for greed and power.
And they are. You mean nothing to them.
And we talk about this on these shows. And you're exactly right. We are nothing but a figure on a spreadsheet. And the fact that the people that you trust the most are willing to do what they do. I mean, perfect title with your book. It's just an illusion. That we live this illusion that we're safe. And we're not.
Well, in the second book, now, after The Methodical Illusion came out, I've had people come forward from that were based in that military base where the planes were brought to.
Yes.
That told me that that base had been evacuated. They were activated the morning the second plane hit the South Tower, supposedly. And when they got to the base, they were denied entrance and locked out. All personnel were evacuated and locked out. They were put up in hotels for 2 to 3 days.
Oh, this is the base to where
all four aircraft were taken to.
So what happened then with those individuals that made the phone call? Now, if this was a prearranged phone call or if it was set up.
That's what I think. Now, I looked at this. I mean, I tore it apart methodically. So on the Flight 11, you had two out of nearly 100 people, two flight attendants make phone calls. They were both saying opposite things. Even Amy Sweeney said that Betty Ong was seated in the second to the last row of coach seats with her. But Betty Ong said she was seated in her jump seat, which is the most aft to jump seat on the right-hand side of the aircraft. And she said that at least a half a dozen times. And so then Amy Sweeney said 9B was the hijacker. And then she said the hijacker really was 10B, and that 9B had been stabbed. She said that a doctor and a nurse were tending to him. And Betty Ong said they called for a doctor and a nurse, but none showed up. They had no medical help at all. So they were saying completely opposite things. Now, since Methodical Illusion came out, I've been talking with a lot of flight attendants, and what we think happened is we think the handler on board, probably 9B on that flight, made an announcement and said that they were part of a drill. Remember, there were lots of military drills going on that day. And he just probably told them they were part of a drill for hijacking procedures or FAA or to test the system. And when they were once they landed, two people were removed from the aircraft and they were taken, like Betty Ong said, he stood upstairs. And in every large hangar, by the way, the base was a C-5 transport base. And so the C-5 transport, that's the plane that's on the Theraflu commercials that opens up the whole nose and it's bigger than a 747. So these hangars for them are huge. And there's like five or six of them there right in a row right along the runway. So they were probably taken up to offices, and that's why everyone that called out on Flight 93 that were the passengers, and most of those passengers never mentioned hijacker or terrorist or anything. They said they were being very kind to us, and they would tell their loved ones goodbye, but you know, they never called them hijackers or anything. So some of those people, they just were told to make phone calls to their loved ones. And that's where they were almost all cell phone calls. And one woman called and gave her family the location of her combination or her key to her safe in her bedroom and told her what was in it. And, you know, I've actually been in contact with someone who's friends with someone who had left a message on their home recorder to say goodbye. And it was very much as if they had the Stockholm syndrome. You know, they're being very kind to us. They didn't say they were hijackers. They just said they. And so I think you see now on Flight 175, and I know we'll probably pick up on our next time we do this, mm-hmm. because these phone calls are really important. But in 175, you had two passengers call out. And lo and behold, when I looked into them, they were both employed by two companies vital to the Department of Defense. And they both said things that they couldn't have known about. And so their stories really don't work. But there again, there was only two people. Now, according to the government story, they were both at row 31, which is almost the very last row. Again, 150 plus feet away from business class, what was going on, where the hijackers were supposedly. And they both said things like the one on the left side, if you were looking out the window, according to what the government radar says, they were about 7,000 feet elevation. And he was directly over just a little bit to the east of Newark International. But he told his mother that they were over Ohio. And so there was a lot of confusion there with Ohio and Cleveland, but I found all that too in this Freedom of Information Act radar data.
You know, and I just want to say to the listeners, referring back to the beginning of this episode, where we're talking about aircrafts thousands of feet in the air, impossible to use a cell phone. These are lengthy cell phone conversations that Rebecca is just talking about here. So something to definitely keep mm-hmm. in your thoughts when we talk about these things.
Yeah, and then these two guys that called off the second flight that was from Boston to L.A., also United 175, they were saying really strange things for where the plane was in altitude. It was only 7,000 feet. Now, let me just tell you this. At the 10,000-foot level, that's when that little chime goes off and the green light happens and the flight attendant makes that announcement. Ladies and gentlemen, please discontinue the use of all electronic devices now. That's 10,000 feet. So you're almost in final descent. And that's when we make that announcement, and then we come through and clear the aircraft of the last bit of garbage and make sure your luggage is stowed and your seatbelt's on. And then we go sit in our jump seats for landing. So that's where you are, 10,000 feet. These guys were around 7. And so it's very easy to look. Now, this would be like flying into any city. If you're flying into L.A. or over Compton or, you know, something like that, it's very easy to look down and say, oh, yeah, I know that. There's the Walmart. Well, this guy's looking at Newark International, and he says he's over Ohio. The other guy who called on the right side of the airplane, he was looking at the Statue of Liberty, the Hudson River, and the Manhattan skyline. And he told his dad, this is now 3 minutes before supposed impact. I don't even think these guys were in the hangar, quite frankly. They could have been calling from offices somewhere, but he told his dad that he thought the hijackers were going to fly them to Chicago and fly them into a building. And the guy on the left side told his mother that their whole bunch of passengers were scheming to go take over the cockpit. That's the scenario from Flight 93 at Shanksville. And I went, uh-oh, somebody has told these two guys the scenario that there's no way they would know. Now, I studied up the hijackers they claimed were on Flight 175, and none of them were fluent in English. So they're not going to go back to row 31 near the very tail of the aircraft and take the chances that some passengers, some male's not going to attack them. And then I looked into that guy on the left side. He was Miramar trained, San Diego. That's Top Gun school.
Right.
This guy was trained in survival, and he was 6'2", 225 pounds, and his friends in the Navy, they said that he was the guy to have if you were ever in a bar fight. He could kill any human being with his bare hands. And yet on that day, we're led to believe that he chose to sit and talk to his mommy on the phone. And the hijackers were not big. They were 5'6", 5'7", 5'8". And so it makes no sense that one of these little tiny scrawny Arab hijackers was going to come back and tell this guy traveling with his wife and three-year-old a plan to fly a plane into a building. But somebody told him that, or he wouldn't have made it on the phone call. And so I realized then that, okay, these guys are either in the hangar or they're calling from an unknown location, because they both end up working for Brian Sweeney, the one on the left side. He worked for MITRE company, M-I-T-R-E. It's a shadow government. They specialize in radar, and he was a radar intercept officer. Wasn't really a pilot for the Navy. But the other guy worked for a company called Time Trade of Waltham, Massachusetts, and they are their biggest contractor, or their client is the DOD, Department of Defense. Their second it's probably the Department of Homeland Security now. So you can see he was that guy was also the vice president of sales for that corporation. So it's very suspicious looking, and it's beyond coincidence when you get into this. So and I decided to just kind of took apart this, you know, flight 77. Then we had one flight attendant and one, you see a pattern here, right? One flight attendant and one passenger, Barbara Olson, and a very junior flight attendant. And the flight attendant did something she should never have done. She called her mom and dad.
Oh.
Now, we have phone numbers that we call at our, you know, 800 numbers that we would call to crew scheduling that could instantly basically hit a button on their panel, and the phone call would be recorded, and the FAA would be contacted, and the security personnel in the corporation also would be contacted, and all this stuff, boom, 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 would go into place. But that's not going to happen if you call your mommy, because your mom's going to go into a panic. She doesn't know any of those phone numbers to call. So again, a flight attendant did something that she shouldn't have done. And but what I'm seeing is this pattern: two people off flight 11, two off 175, two off 77. Now, by the time flight 93 was brought into that hangar, all of the handlers on board each of the other three aircraft were free, and 11 people made phone calls off that one. Some of them that we were led to believe were the Let's Roll heroes. Let me tell you a little something about those guys. They were all 6'1" to 6'4", aggressively athletic. One of them was playing rugby in a rugby team. They all four played rugby in college. One wanted to be a professional ball player, so he was into baseball and football, quarterback. And one was a college judo champion. And they were all 6'1" to 6'4", 220-plus pounds, at aggressively competitive. And Mark Bingham, the one that called his mother and said, "Hi, Mom, this is Mark Bingham. We've been hijacked. We're up in the air. You do believe me, don't you, Mom?" He ran a public relations company, and he had just recently fought off an armed mugger with a gun with his bare hands, and all of his office people and talk about that. Well, they just remember he had just fought this guy. But yet on, we are led to believe on flight 93, nobody did anything that could have. And so that was a combination of people that were involved in the plot. And again, there's really weird connections. Like Todd Beamer's phone kept making phone calls until late in the evening, like 8 or 9 o'clock that night. His cell phone. Now, nothing survived Shanksville.
Right.
So how did Todd Beamer's phone keep making phone calls? Okay, Todd Beamer had also just been in Rome on vacation with his wife, but he'd also right before that been in Israel. And another really weird thing about Todd Beamer, he worked for Oracle, and the CEO of Oracle, who's also very involved in several interesting companies, biotechs and communication companies in Israel, Larry Ellison did something really weird. 12 to 14 hours before it was ever made public by the airline or the FBI, the whole Let's Roll story, he put that whole story in an email to people in Oracle. But Lisa Beamer, Todd's wife, didn't even know the details, and they hadn't been made public to anyone. So how did the president, CEO of Oracle, know the scenario and the story? And you'll remember, they made a Hollywood movie out of this to reinforce this right away.
You know, I noticed that. They did not wait long to have movies regarding 9/11. I think that's all part of the propaganda.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I have one comment, and then I have one last question before we close this first episode with you, is CNN aired that Building 7 collapsed well before it even collapsed. And I think for those of you that have never done any type of research regarding 9/11, this was a huge mistake because it's out there all over the internet.
That was actually, I don't know how it got to CNN, but BBC.
Oh, BBC, I'm sorry.
Jane Stanley was her name, and she was actually standing in a building, and you can see the Solomon Building, also known as Building 7, and she's talking about it, and she's saying it had collapsed, and it's standing behind her, still standing. But the interesting connection with this is there are a few interesting people that are also Sayeret Matkal, like 9B. 9B on Flight 11, a trained assassin, Bibi Netanyahu, and the other prime minister, Ehud Barak. Now, interestingly enough, Ehud Barak was in New York the night before, and then he flew to Boston. He flew to London, and so he was sitting in the BBC studios, and he would have been the one to tell Jane Stanley or the person who filled her teleprompter that the Solomon Building had fallen down. But you see, he is ahead of us in time, I guess. So he was psychic, I guess. It's really crazy because she announced that, I believe, 20 minutes or so before it actually did collapse. And there were just small office fires in that building that should not have collapsed. But you know, you saw the collapse. I saw it on television live when it happened. And I saw a controlled demolition. No ifs, ands, or buts about it. My first reaction was, how did they get that wired so quickly?
Exactly.
Because that was definitely controlled demolition. But yeah, Ehud Barak was in the BBC studios that morning. Right away, he was telling us that this was an act of terror. And he's the one to coin the phrase war on terror. Yeah, it's a very interesting connection to that Sayeret Matkal.
Interesting indeed.
And when we talk again next time, we will talk about some more information about the art students that were traveling. And those kind of connections, and then all the connections to the people who made phone calls, and the connections to Barbara Olson are truly incredible. Because, you know, when I started looking into this, I thought those two men that called in on Flight 175 were just innocent victims. I thought, wow, what are the chances? But then when I started reading this guy's obituary, Brian Sweeney, and then his pilot's wife contacted me. She said, he's not a pilot. It's called an RIO. It's a radar intercepting officer. And he sits in the back seat when you have a fighter pilots with the front and the back. The front guy's the pilot. And I didn't know. I just learned all that from the FBI and what his mother told the FBI in the transcripts that I had. So I sent that off to her and I said, well, according to the FBI and his mother, he was a pilot. She was like, no, he's a radar. But how handy would it be to have a radar specialist involved that day? And then when I found in his obituary that he was an employee of MITRE. Now, MITRE and PTEC are two companies that were in the FAA headquarters for 2 years prior to 9/11. So they were able to do a lot of stuff with radar.
I'm just sitting over here shaking my head. It's just, it's information overload. Again, like, you know, when we first talked, when we connected here, it's, you know, you're very skeptical. We know that there is something beyond what the general public knows. But listening to you and all of your research, it's confirming at a level that is undeniable that this is much bigger than what people think it is. And as an American, it's troubling. As an American, it's troubling because this is not the America that we've grown to know and understand. And that's the part that bothers me the most.
Well, you know, the sad part to me, too, is that we're over in the Middle East killing, murdering people for 14 years. We've got all these refugees. Why are they refugees? Because we're bombing their country. Why are we bombing their country? Because they have uranium, they have gas, and they have oil.
Yep.
And maybe some other. I mean, there's those countries over there, Iran, Afghanistan, Iraq. Those countries are very rich in lots of natural resources. So, and it's all done. And now, if people don't think that for a minute that this wasn't pre-planned, if you look up Project for a New American Century, it's often referred to as PNAC, P-N-A-C, and read about that's where they called for a new Pearl Harbor in order to rally the American people behind these seven pre-planned wars. This was written in 1999. And it's signed by none other than Jeb Bush. And almost everybody else you will see on any program, any news program, they're all considered experts. They're terrorist experts, or they're financial experts, or they're some experts. You'll recognize the signers because there's a lot of them. And those would be the people who planned the new Pearl Harbor of 9/11.
Well, what the heck? We might as well make him a president then.
Yeah. Yeah. Like you said the other night at the little program they did. His brother kept us safe.
Yeah, he sure did. He sure did. So, Rebecca, thank you. This here, folks, this is a part. I have a feeling that we haven't even stuck our foreheads into the rabbit hole yet. This is so much information. And again, you coming on and taking your time out, I'm extremely grateful. And if anybody, which I strongly suggest, go to her website, Rebecca Roth. It's R-E-B-E-K-A-H. Roth.com or Methodical Illusion or Methodical Deception.com. Please support her work, her efforts, her research. Order her book, and we have to get you back on here. We need to continue this conversation. People need to know this.
Well, I'd love to join you again. We'll put some time together and continue this story, because there's a whole lot more.
Spooky. This is spooky stuff. I don't even know what to say right now, and usually I am definitely not a man short of words. Most people that listen to me know that. So, folks, stand by. We're going to come back from a quick break, and we're going to do a quick closing. And once again, this is Rocky, and you're listening to EBN Special Report with me and my guest, Miss Rebecca Roth. Stand by, folks.
Today in school, I learned a lot. In chemistry, I learned that no one likes me. In English, I learned that I'm disgusting. And in physics, I learned that I'm a loser.
Today in school, I learned that I'm ugly and useless. And in gym, I learned that I'm pathetic and a joke. In history, I learned that I'm trash.
Today in school, I learned that I have no friends.
In biology,
in English, I learned that I make people sick. And at lunch, I learned that I sit on my own because I smell. In chemistry, I learned that no one likes
me. In biology, I learned that I'm fat and stupid. And in math, I learned that I'm trash.
The only thing I didn't learn in school today.
The
only thing I didn't learn
is why no one ever helps.
Kids witness bullying every day. They want to help, but they don't know how. Teach them how to stop bullying and be more than a bystander at stopbullying.gov. A message from the Ad Council.
Well, that's going to do it for us here tonight, folks, on this episode of EBN Special Report. Once again, I would like to thank Miss Rebecca Roth for coming on to the show, for her work, for her research, for her courage to come forward and to expose the corruption that is happening throughout the world. You can visit my site at www.ebntalkradio.net. Send me an email at ebntalkradio@gmail.com. Visit Rebecca's site, methodicalillusion.com and methodicaldeception.com, or RebeccaRoth.com, R-E-B-E-K-A-H. So with that being said, folks, I am extremely grateful for each and every one of you. So from my family to yours, much love and much respect. Good night, everybody.